From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Almost 2 years after the death of country music star Charlie Rich, his music is being revived on a series of reissues. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll feature a 1992 interview with Charlie Rich. There's more good news on the reissue front. Folklorist Alan Lomax's lifetime of recordings will be released in a new series on Rounder Records, including his field recordings of prison songs, spirituals, and blues. We'll feature a 1990 interview with Lomax. Also, Lloyd Schwartz reviews the American debut concert of pianist David Helfgott, whose life is portrayed in the film Shine. And John Powers reviews Howard Stern's new film autobiography, Private Parts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton holds a news conference this afternoon. It's likely to be dominated by White House fundraising practices. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton's aides say he is determined to get his message out despite the relentless focus on his fundraising practices. Almost every day, the White House has been hit with new questions about whether the way it raised money last year was legal and proper. Mr. Clinton will open the press conference with a brief statement about his legislative priorities. Then he will probably be asked about Al Gore's fundraising. The vice president admitted to making fundraising phone calls on White House property. There are laws prohibiting soliciting or accepting campaign funds on federal grounds, but Gore says the law does not apply to him. The president may also be asked about statements his party chair has made. Colorado Governor Roy Romer said it was wrong and ill-advised for Maggie Williams, the First Lady's chief of staff, to accept a campaign donation in the White House. Williams says she merely took the check and passed it on to the Democratic National Committee. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Some officials think that the worst of the flooding may be through for much of the upper Ohio River Valley. The National Weather Service says the river shouldn't rise much more, although there will be fluctuations depending on the territory. Louisville, Kentucky is still waiting for the Ohio River to crest later today. It's worse further downstream in Illinois, where the problems are beginning to mount. The Ohio River empties into the Mississippi River, and the Mississippi is already flooded. More rain is forecast for this weekend. The former police chief of Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, has been indicted in Miami today on charges he helped to smuggle 33 tons of drugs from Colombia to the United States. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports from Miami.
The exiled police official, alleged to have been the strongman behind Haiti's former military dictators, is charged with setting up shipments with Colombian drug smugglers via a private airstrip in Haiti. Lieutenant Colonel Michel Francois has been in exile in the Dominican Republic since 1994, shortly after U.S. troops returned ousted Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide to power. Francois was arrested in Honduras. He's to be flown to Miami on Saturday. 12 other people are also named in the indictment. They include a security worker at Miami International Airport charged with escorting drug couriers off flights from Haiti. Representatives of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Miami are calling these some of the most important drug-related indictments in the city in some time. In Miami, I'm Cheryl Duvall.
Reports from Beijing say an explosion at a bus stop hurt at least 8 people today. Many of the injured are badly burned. The cause of the blast is not known, but there has been a spate of bus bombings in western China. A large Muslim population there wants more autonomy. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 60 points at 7,005. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is significantly higher today on renewed hopes of stable interest rates. The Dow and the Nasdaq are both up. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports from New York.
The market is being boosted by this morning's report on February employment, which shows a healthy economy with low inflation. While job growth was stronger than expected last month, labor costs were contained. Analysts believe this news will keep the Federal Reserve from raising interest rates at this month's policy meeting. As a result, many interest rate-sensitive stock groups have gained, like banks and financial services. And computer-related issues are advancing, led by Texas Instruments, which has added 4%, following positive remarks from Merrill Lynch. I'm Doug Krisner.
United Parcel Service is now taking passengers aboard its trademark brown planes. UPS says it can easily convert its Boeing 727s to carry people in about 4 hours' time. Weekend passenger flights are scheduled to start next week. Flights must be booked through tour operators. The United Nations says the destruction of the world's forests remains heavy, but there are signs that deforestation is slowing down. From 1980 to 1990, the report says, the Earth lost an average of 38.3 million acres of forest every year. But over the next 5 years, that figure dipped to 33.8 million acres. The report says the figures cover both natural forests and trees planted for harvesting, and the UN studied the issue because forests and trees play a role in food security by providing food and wood for cooking, generating income to buy food, and protecting agricultural resources. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from MRI, Management Recruiters International, offering a variety of staffing solutions through its management recruiters and sales consultants divisions.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Country music star Charlie Rich died in 1995. Now his work is being revived in a series of reissues. Epic Records has released the compilation Feel Like Going Home, The Essential Charlie Rich. Koch has re-released three Rich albums. On this archive edition, we have a 1992 interview with him. Charlie Rich was one of country music's big stars in the 70s, but if all you know of him is his hits like The Most Beautiful Girl and Behind Closed Doors, then you've only heard one side of him. He got his start as a rockabilly singer in the 50s. In the 60s, he had the novelty hit Mohair Sam, but there were many lean years in that decade. The 70s brought fame, but it also brought musical compromise. His final CD, Pictures and Paintings, showcased him without the big orchestras and backup singers of his country years. The title song, a Doc Pomus Dr. John collaboration called Pictures and Paintings, is also on the new compilation Feel Like Going Home. Charlie Rich is at the piano.
Pictures and paintings are etched in my heart for a love with no ending that never had a chance to start. Now all I am left with, all that I have, are pictures and paintings etched to my heart. Pictures and paintings are etched in my head.
I'd like to talk with you about your life. Maybe we can start with your childhood. You grew up, I believe, on a family plantation?
Yes, that's right.
So your family owned a plantation in Arkansas?
Yes. It was actually a rental type thing. My father was a planter, and he rented like about 3,000 acres of land and farmed it. I guess that's probably where I first, you know, heard the blues that I still enjoy so much and everything, was on this plantation.
So you were exposed to black music from the people who worked on the plantation?
That's true.
How did you make friends with the people there? I assume that they were older than you were.
Well, they, you know, some were older, some weren't. The one of my main people was a guy named C.J., and he kind of taught me some blues licks, and I used to sit and watch him play piano and that sort of thing. And he was kind of a honky-tonk piano player for the time. And of course, there was quite a few blues things around Memphis, which the plantation was over in Arkansas, but it's only about 30 miles from Memphis. So Memphis had a pretty good blues thing to start with, you know.
Did you go to black churches and listen to the music there?
Well, didn't really have to go. I did, but, you know, you could hear it like on a Sunday, or if you're riding your horse down the path or whatever, you could hear the black music come from the black churches. And as a matter of fact, in the, you know, in the cotton fields and that sort of thing, you could hear the singing and the something that was contagious, kind of.
I believe your parents were Baptist missionaries?
That's true.
And they sang in a gospel quartet. What did they think of you learning the blues? Did they object to that?
No, they did not. No. As a matter of fact, my father and the sharecropper I was telling you about, C.J., they used to get together for, you know, some Saturday night sessions. My dad played guitar and C.J. played piano and that sort of thing. So there was no, really no racist thing or any of that to speak of, even though the times were that way. In our particular situation, it just never occurred that way.
So did you ever sing gospel music yourself?
Well, of course, when, you know, when we went to church and that sort of thing, I sang what I guess we consider now white gospel music, which is, in a sense, kind of like the quartet-type singing. My mother played piano, my dad sang, and two or three of their friends sang, and kind of, they did a lot of churches, and they did some radio shows and things like that, and they took me one time to a little station in Jonesboro, Arkansas, and I was supposed to sing, and they put a chair under me to, so I could reach up to the mic, but I never did sing. I was shell-shocked or something, mic-shocked maybe. But anyway, the quartet was performing, and I was supposed to sing a thing myself, but I couldn't get any sound to come out.
How old were you?
And I still, in a sense, sometimes have a problem with that.
How old were you when this happened?
Oh, I was about 5 or 6.
When you actually started performing, was stage fright ever a serious problem?
Well, I think so, yes. I don't know if that's... I don't know whether it's that or, like, anxiety or some of the new names they have for things now, but... like once, you know, once the ball's kicked off, everything's fine. But before that, it's a little nerve wracking. Yes,
right.
Still, it's anxiety panic disorder. I think is what they call it now.
A fancy
bad business
name,
to be in, huh?
Yeah. If you're just joining us, my guest is Charlie Rich, and he, by the way, has a new album called Pictures and Paintings. Now, what about piano? How did you start playing? Was there a piano in your house?
We had a piano in the house, and my mother played. I have two sisters, and they both took piano lessons, and I took from about the 3rd grade till about the 9th grade, and then decided I wanted to play football, and I did that, and in the meantime, I was learning to play saxophone in the band, and only after I got back into the, when I went into the Air Force, did I actually start playing piano again, as professionally, so to speak.
You were in an Air Force band?
Yes, in Enid, Oklahoma.
Now, I think your first real professional break came when your wife, Margaret Ann, took a tape of your songs to the Sun Studios in Memphis. And I was wondering if she did that secretly or if you knew that she was going to do that.
She did it secretly. At that time, we had just gotten out of the... because we got married while I was in the Air Force. And I was 19, and she was 18, and we didn't have anything to do, and we had 2 kids and another one on the way. And I was getting out of the Air Force, so I didn't have a check coming in. So my uncle set me up in the farming business over across the river in West Memphis. And is where I was doing some stuff just at home and putting it on a little web cord recorder. And she took some of it secretly over to Bill Justice at Sun Record Company. And he gave her, he was nice to her and everything, but he gave her a Jerry Lee Lewis record and said, go tell Charlie when he can play that bad, come see me. Because Jerry was real hot at the time, you know.
Yeah, and Sun was the studio that had Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis and Carl Perkins. Would you have had the nerve to take that tape to Sun yourself?
Well, at the time, I was busy, like, you know, with another occupation or trying to be. And I didn't really know that much about the recording industry and that sort of thing. If it hadn't been for my wife, probably the tape would never have gotten to Bill, and I don't know where I'd be now. I may be driving a tractor or something.
Right. Well, the first record that you made for Sun Studios. It was a song of yours called Lonely Weekends.
Right.
And you recorded it in 1950.
60, wasn't it?
Excuse me?
59 or 60?
I'm sorry. You recorded it in 1959. How did you get to record this?
I had written that song, and as we got the ball rolling, so to speak, Sam got interested in the stuff we were writing more so than being an artist. And I think I wrote that for Elvis or Jerry Lee or whoever would cut it, probably. And I guess we got a pretty good demo on it. And so Sam decided we'd cut it on me, and we did, and ended up getting a good cut. And it was the first record that we had out that, you know, that did quite well for us back, I think it was 1959 or 60.
Let me play it. And this is Charlie Rich, Lonely Weekends.
Well, I make it all right.
Well, I make it all right.
From Monday morning to Friday night.
Oh, those lonely
weekends. Since you left me.
Since you left me.
I'm as lonely as I can be.
Oh, those lonely weekends.
Said you'd be.
Listening to that, it sounds like you were a little influenced in your singing back then by Elvis Presley. Did you think of yourself as being influenced by him then?
Back then, everybody, in a sense, tried to, if, you know, they tried to either write something that Elvis would like or would do or would maybe even, you know, imitate him if they could to some degree. And being it was my first time out, I didn't know, I guess, what else to do. I don't think jazz was selling real great about that time. But so I think, in a sense, he set a style that a lot of different people, including myself, tried to imitate to some degree, knowingly or unknowingly.
We're featuring a 1992 interview with the late Charlie Rich. There are several new reissues of his music. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Charlie Rich is joining us. In the 1970s, you hooked up with the record producer Billy Sherrill, and he produced your really big hits, like The Most Beautiful Girl and Behind Closed Doors. How did you meet up with him and start working with him?
Well, I at the time, I had met Billy before as an engineer for Sun Records in Nashville. Sam also had a studio in Nashville, so we went over there one time and recorded some things, and Billy was the engineer on the session, so that was really the first place I met him. Next time I met him, he was kind of the head producer over at Epic Records in Nashville, and we worked together for about 3 or 4 years. And we did stuff like, you say, The Most Beautiful Girl, and Behind Closed Doors, and I Take It On Home, and quite a few different things. And some worked and some didn't, but those were the biggest selling records. And of course, that meant, you know, overseas tours and moving around a lot, and finally we even played Las Vegas quite a bit and places like that. So it just led to quite a bit of work.
Well, I want to play The Most Beautiful Girl, and I have to tell you that, you know, I just recently went back and listened to this record again, and you sing so soulfully on it. You really sing beautifully on it. I'll confess that when it was a hit, I used to just, like, hear it in the background a lot, and I wouldn't always, you know, pay that careful attention to it, like one does with a lot of hits, you know, that you're just hearing, like, on jukeboxes and in stores and in the background on the radio. But you really sing so well on it.
Well, thank you. That's very nice of you.
So let's give this a spin.
Okay.
And this is Charlie Rich, one of his big hits, The Most Beautiful Girl.
Hey, did you happen to see the most beautiful girl in the world? And if you did, was she crying, crying? Hey, if you happened to see the most beautiful girl that walked out on me, tell her I'm sorry. Tell her I need my baby. Oh, won't you tell her that I love her?
Did you feel that you fit in with the country music crowd in the 70s?
Well, I traveled with country music folk and played country music shows and auditoriums, and I liked country music, but that wasn't all that I liked. And I still think there's some great country records out there, and some good things come out of country music. I just can't seem to just stay in one particular thing, because I feel like it kind of makes me stale if I try to stay in one particular category. And so I venture out on a lot of new things. Some work, some don't.
In 1974, you won the Country Music Award for Entertainer of the Year. And in the next year, 1975, you were presenting the award to the winner, and you opened up the envelope, which revealed that the winner was John Denver. So what you did was you took out your cigarette lighter and burned the piece of paper that announced who the winner was. What was going through your mind when you did that?
It's kind of strange. There were a lot of on that particular instance, there were a lot of people asking me if it was a form of rebellion or what have you, or something of that nature, or if I didn't like John Denver, or if, but actually that wasn't the situation at all. Things at those awards shows and things can get pretty hectic in the back before you even go on stage and what have you. And it seems like millions of people running around back there and that sort of thing. And I guess my anxiety panic disorder kicked in or something. But there was no intent as far as trying to make a statement. It was just kind of a mistake. But, you know, I've made a few before.
Well, no matter how it was intended, I'm sure a lot of people interpret it as a slam to John Denver. I was wondering if there were any consequences that you suffered as a result of having, you know, done this at the Country Music Awards.
Well, I don't know. It may have, it's hard to say exactly. It may have been that I had been overworked in 73, 74, 75, and that sort of thing. And maybe I was rebelling, but not against John Denver and not against country music. It was just, like I say, it was just a mistake that I made that I guess was important. But actually, I think everything works to the good. So Maybe I was saying, well, I want to try something else besides country or something. I don't know.
So you think it was, in your own way, a way of getting out?
I think maybe so, yes.
Was that the result?
Well, it was. I kept on recording and went with another couple of labels and some different producers and that sort of thing, and I just said that I don't want to just do just country-type stuff the rest of my life. I want to do some different things.
On the back of your new compact disc, there's a picture of your hands on the piano, and you're holding a cigarette in one of your hands.
Right.
You still smoke?
Yes. As a matter of fact, the engineer was kind enough to bring me an ashtray in a no-smoking area here where I'm talking to you. But I still do, and I don't recommend it to anybody, but I don't know. It's just a thing I've done all my life. And
do you think it's affected your voice at all?
I don't know. I started to cut an album with a guy out in California one time, and I was trying to quit smoking, and he said, that's doing something to your voice that's not right. So I started smoking again and have been ever since. And the album didn't do that well, so I guess maybe I should keep on smoking.
Well, Charlie Rich, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Terry, it's nice to talk to you.
Charlie Rich recorded in 1992, 3 years before his death. Koch Records has just reissued three of his CDs, and Epic has brought out a compilation called Feel Like Going Home. It includes this 1973 demo of the title song. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Lord, I feel like going home. Tried and I failed, and I'm tired and weary. And everything I done was wrong. And I feel like gold. Lord, I tried to see it through, but it was too much for me. And now I've come.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up from the archives, an interview with folklorist Alan Lomax. A lifetime of his work will soon be reissued on CD. Also, is David Helfgott a musical genius, as depicted in the film Shine? Lloyd Schwartz reviews his first American concert. And John Powers reviews Howard Stern's Private Parts.
I walked on, wait for me, St. Louis. St. Louis to you. Got nobody. No one to feel my kin.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A lifetime of recordings made by folklorist Alan Lomax is about to be reissued on CD. The new series, the Alan Lomax Collection, produced by Rounder Records, will include out-of-print recordings and unreleased material from his archive. Lomax, who is now 82 and recovering from two strokes, has devoted his life to the study of folk culture in America and around the world. His father, John Lomax, was one of the first popularizers of American folk songs. The father and son were the first folklorists to travel around the American South, recording songs on portable record machines. They both contributed thousands of field recordings to the Library of Congress's Archive of American Folk Song, which John Lomax founded in 1941. The first CDs in the new Alan Lomax collection will be released in April. But next week, Rounder will release a CD of recordings made by Lomax for the Library of Congress in the early 40s called Negro Blues and Hollers. This recording, made in Clarksdale, Mississippi in 1941, features Son House, Willie Brown, and Fiddling Joe Martin.
Well, if I had a followed, boys, my old second mind, I'd say I'd have been up the country my old second time.
Yes, ooh. Yes.
Boy, I'm feeling low down today.
I know you, son. Go sing them old Little Camp Blues. I know you got them.
Oh, Mr. Charlie, Mr. Ludlow Joe. Huh? I'd undecided, oh boy, I won't work no more.
Boy, look at here. Oh, I'm going to get a little cowboy dosha. Lord, for the hold my head.
Slip your own, boy.
I'm going to get more dosha women for the make up my bed.
Hey, get up there, will you?
Well, look at here, boy.
You've sure seen technology change in recording folk culture over the years. Now, in your early days, you used one of the first portable recording machines, right?
Actually, the first machine that my father and I took out was a Thomas Edison cylinder machine. And then the Library of Congress kindly replaced that with a disc machine that embossed the groove on an aluminum disc. But for a long time, I was a media bug because I saw that the job of the folklorist was to make a bridge between people who had no voice and the big world of communication. And that's what I did for the first, half of my life, was simply run with a recording machine and record. Here in the West Indies, in Italy, in Spain, in Great Britain, and to encourage other people to do it and to publish the results, because this was the way that people could learn that other folks were out there just as interesting as they were. That's the first big lesson of the recording machine.
When you first started recording, you were a teenager and you were on the road with your father. What were your responsibilities in those very early days?
Well, basically, I ran the machine and lifted it and carried it. The whole thing weighed about 500 pounds, and I broke it down and put it in the back of our Ford, Model A Ford, often two or three times a day. It kept the fat off of me.
Were you interested in this, or were you just doing this to please your father when you were a teenager?
Well, no. I mean, I was an anthropologist in college and a radical, and I wanted to go along to see what was happening in the South. I'd been a Southern kid, and I knew what my middle-class surround said, which was that blacks were perfectly content with their lot, was a lot of hooey. But I couldn't prove it because you couldn't get any information on the subject. There was nobody who was talking out of school. It was too dangerous. And so I went out to see what I could find out in the background of the recording sessions. And gradually, I began to learn how to get to know blacks, even though it was dangerous for them and to some extent for me.
You and your father were, I think, the first people to actually record in prison camps in the South. Why did you want to go there to record songs?
Well, there's always been an anomaly in the black community. All secular songs, and this follows out my Calvinist hypothesis, were considered sinful. Anything that wasn't religious was sinful. So that the whole of the secular, great secular song art of the black, the blues, the hollers, the work songs, all the casual songs of amusement were forbidden. You could be church. You could be kicked out of the church for singing them if you were a black person in a respectable black community. So that it was very difficult for us to get at this rich and unknown treasure trove of American music and lyricism without in the normal black community. People were scared to sing them, scared of criticism. So we decided to go where the devils were. I mean, the people who were beyond redemption. And we found them in the prisons, and we recorded a whole literature, which is still virtually unknown. Song bag of beautiful tunes, new kinds of melodies, and all sorts of things we found in the prison camps of the South. But the blacks were overjoyed to have a chance to do something, to let their problems be known, and because they had put tremendous a lot of their feelings and sorrows into these songs.
I think the best known of the recordings that you made of prisoners was your recordings with Leadbelly, and you continued to record him after he got out.
Yeah, we did the first singer biography of him.
Let me play one of the recordings you made by Leadbelly, and this is Midnight Special. Would you like to say a few words about the circumstances under which you recorded it or the song itself? And you might want to tell us, too, how you met Leadbelly.
Well, Leadbelly had been in the Texas pen a couple of times, but we found him in the Louisiana penitentiary, where prisoners were not allowed to sing in the fields, but they could have their own entertainers. And Leadbelly was a camp entertainer. He had his guitar there. And we went to camp number one, and when he heard we were there, he ran 100 yards from his cell to where we were, arrived without even breathing hard, and sat down and sang. Irene Goodnight was the first song he sang us, and he sang a song to appeal to the governor of Louisiana to let him out of there, because woman was mourning for him. And then he sang, among other things, the great Midnight Special, which is actually the song of the main theme song of the Texas Penitentiary, Let the Midnight Special Shine Its Ever-Loving Light on You. Think of prisoners who don't know whether they'll live through the next day, who are working from dawn in the morning till dark at night, who, if they fall afoul of a guard, may be beaten to death, hanging on the bars, absolutely stone-weary, wiped out, and watching the headlight of some onrushing train flash across the walls of their prison and into their faces. That's the mood of the song.
About an A-bar and the dress she wore, umbrella on the shoulder, see the paper in her hand. Well, I'm going in at the governor, he's trying to lose her, my man. Let the midnight special shine your light on me. Let the midnight special shine your heaven-loving light on me. When I get up in the morning, when that big bell rings, over marching to the table, need the same old thing, not the talkers on the table, and nothing in my pants. Never said a thing about it, have trouble with the man, let the midnight special shine your light on me. Let the midnight special shine your ever-loving light on me.
That's Leadbelly, and that was recorded by you and your father?
Well, I don't know. I've recorded it so many times with him, I don't know.
I see, okay,
which
right.
Recording was which.
Did Leadbelly write Midnight Special?
No. He recomposed it. All black singers always, you know, remake it. Remake the song they sing. So they say, I'm the composer. Composed by whoever it was, even if they sing a song that's well known from some other source.
When Leadbelly was released from prison, he traveled with your father for a couple of years, and your father put on a lot of concerts for him. Do you have any memories of what it was like for Leadbelly going from the South to the North and suddenly, like, performing for folklorists, for intellectuals, performing at Harvard University? Was there a period of culture shock and serious adaptation for him?
Not at all. He was just in triumph. In his mind, and it was true, he was the best in the world. He was the king of the 12-string guitar players in the world. He had a voice you could hear for a mile, an absolutely beautiful silvery tenor voice. It's never been heard, by the way. It's only on our first recordings.
We're featuring an interview from the archive with folklorist Alan Lomax. Rounder Records will soon begin to reissue his lifetime of work. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1990 interview with folklorist Alan Lomax.
I want to ask you about, I think, what's considered to be among the most important recordings you've ever made, and I'm thinking of the recordings you made with Jelly Roll Morton, the Library of Congress recordings, which features both him singing and playing, as well as talking about his life. How did you get to make those recordings with him?
Well, as I used a recording machine in the field, I began to discover that what an artist would say about the song at the end of a performance was usually psychologically and emotionally very revealing. And I began to record more and more of these codas to songs. And gradually, the codas began to stretch out longer and longer until I was recording whole life histories. And I had done a number of these by the time Jelly Roll came to the Library of Congress, anxious to prove to the world that jazz was not from Memphis, as Handy had said it was in a Billboard interview, but was from New Orleans. And Jelly Roll, an extraordinary intellectual he was, had the whole story worked out when he came to me in my office, which was backstage of the Coolidge Auditorium, the Library of Congress. On the stage was a grand piano. Around the hall, there were the busts of Bach and Beethoven. Jelly Roll sat down at the piano, completely at home with his peers, because he was, after all, our first literate native composer, and began to tell the story of jazz. Naturally, I was no great friend of jazz at the time, because jazz was what was driving folk music into obscurity, in my view. But this man was so fascinating that I thought I would try to find out how much, well, folklore there was in him. And within an hour, he'd said such wonderful things that I raced upstairs, got permission to work with him for a week and to use any number of discs to take down his life. That's how it all happened.
Let me play a short excerpt of the oral history that you recorded. Jelly Roll Morton is talking about when he started to play in the Tenderloin District in New Orleans.
In my younger days, I was brought in to the Tenderloin District by friends, young friends, of course. Even before we were in long pants, we used to steal long pants from around the fathers and brothers and uncles and so forth and so on.
Could you go down there before you had long pants on?
No, why, the policeman would run you right in jail, would run you ragged. Of course, we kids from time to time would climb those 8 and 10 feet high board fences. We'd really climb them and get away from these people, but they kept us right out of the district. They'd take the straps on the end of the clubs and just make switches out of them, cut our legs into ribbons, and was very frightened, very much frightened. I happened to invade that section, one of the sections of the district where the birth of jazz originated.
Where was that? How old were you?
At that time, that was the year of 1902. I was about 17 years old. I happened to go to Villeray and Bienville. At that time, one of the most famous night spots after everything was closed. It was only a back room where all the greatest pianists frequented after they got off from work. All the pianists got off from work in the sporting houses at around 4 or after, unless they had plenty of money involved. And they would go to this Frenchman's. That was the name of the place. Saloon, and there would be everything in the line of hilarity there. They would have even millionaires to come to listen to the different great pianists. what would no doubt be their favorites maybe among them.
Jillero Morton, recorded by my guest Alan Lomax back in 1938. How do you think your role as folklorist has changed over the years? Or perhaps I should ask, how do you think the role of the folklorist has changed?
Well, so far as I'm concerned, I'm still doing the thing that I was inspired to do in my early recording sessions, when people would look at the microphone and say, "Mr. President, I want you to come down here and help us people where we are in our hard times in this place." They looked at my father and myself as a channel to tell their troubles and to let their lives be known. That's what I've essentially tried to do all my life.
Alan Lomax recorded in 1990. Rounder Records will bring out the first CDs in its new series, The Alan Lomax Collection, on April 22nd. Here's one of his prison recordings.
I'm going home, oh yes. I'm going home, oh yes. I'm going home, Lord, Lord. I'm going home, I'm going home, Lord, Lord. I'm going home. My baby sister's crying. My baby sister's crying. Brother, come home, Lord, Lord. Brother, come home. Brother, come home, Lord, Lord. Brother, come home. I'm going home, oh yes. I'm going home, oh yes. I'm going home, Lord, Lord. I'm going home, Lord, Lord, I'm going home.
Last Tuesday night, pianist David Helfgott, whose painful personal history and apparent triumph over mental illness are depicted in the Oscar-nominated movie Shine, launched his 18-concert North American Celebration of Life tour in Boston Symphony Hall. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz was there. Here's his report.
I confess I was curious. I didn't care much for Shine, which I found coldly manipulative, and I'm not a fan of either the soundtrack CD or David Helfgott's live recording of Rach 3, as characters in the film keep calling Rachmaninoff's third piano concerto to prove they're musicians. Still, something in me wanted to be present for Helfgott's first appearance in this country. But I'm sorry I went. I can't remember being so thoroughly depressed by a public performance. The press ticket situation ought to have been a tip-off. Music critics were offered no complimentary tickets. Everyone is welcome to share the joy of David's celebration, the publicity director of the national tour told me. But they didn't need press for sold-out concerts. This also suggests a desire on the part of Helfgott's handlers to avoid serious critical evaluation. And now that I've shared David's joy, I can't blame them. Neither the movie nor the CDs, which are now Billboard's number one classical and crossover classical albums, prepared me for the pathetic incompetence of Helfgott's playing. Helfgott himself is an endearing figure. He came bounding onto the stage wearing a white, puffy shirt with ruffled cuffs, like the one on Seinfeld that Jerry gets trapped into wearing for an appearance on the Today Show. He trotted to the center of the stage to greet the applause, then immediately sat down and began to play a brief program that lasted only an hour and a half, including the intermission. The selections by Mendelssohn, Chopin, Liszt, and Beethoven were challenging but pretty safe. Helfgott is like a talented amateur who can handle most of the notes, but he has no focus, no concentration, and little musical understanding. His sense of rhythm is erratic. The faster he plays, the fewer notes he hits. The slower he plays, the more the musical line dissolves into a muffled muddle. What was most surprising to hear in person was his lack of any real projection or personal touch or color. No color, no poetry. Except when he suddenly played very loud, the notes were actually hard to hear. Like Glenn Gould or Pablo Casals, he groans, growls, or mutters along with the music. But the quieter the playing, the louder the vocals. People giggled, couples elbowed each other. He got more giggles in a Chopin ballade when he kept scratching his side with his right hand, Simeon fashion, when he wasn't conducting with it. This ballade had so little momentum, the audience thought it was over and interrupted with applause. He jumped up, bowed, then played the rest as if he were starting a new piece. The other misplaced applause came after the first movement of Beethoven's Waldstein Sonata. But this was a more excusable mistake, since the only way anyone who wasn't familiar with classical music could have known it had more than one movement was to buy a $15 souvenir program book. The people behind me were calling this event a great human celebration. Certainly, Helfgott seemed to be having a ball, grinning and leaping up from his chair to get his ovations, shaking hands with front row well-wishers. I think he had no sense of how badly he'd played. But was this a triumph over an infirmity or merely cashing in on it? During intermission, a friend came up to me, relieved to find someone who shared his dismay. "It makes me queasy," he remarked. "This isn't a concert, it's a freak show."
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. David Helfgott plays Rachmaninoff on his new CD. Coming up, a review of Howard Stern's new movie, Private Parts. This is Fresh Air. When Howard Stern appeared in drag at bookstores to hawk his autobiography, fans lined up in the streets and blocked traffic. What can we expect from the film version that opens today? Our film critic John Power says this time Howard may be looking for respectability.
Love him or loathe him, everyone knows Howard Stern, the radio shock jock with the heavy metal tresses and the runaway id. He'll cheerfully break wind into the microphone or ask women guests to show him their breasts. Now he wants to be a movie star. His first picture, Private Parts, is like a sitcom version of The People versus Larry Flint. Beginning with Howard's suburban boyhood, when his father was forever calling him a moron, it traces the defining moments of his life. We see the nebbishy college kid being scorned by the chicks and screwing up on the air. We see him meet his wife, Allison, to whom he's famously faithful, and his chuckling sidekick, Robin Quivers. We see the epic-making moment when he decides to say, on the air, whatever comes into his head. And we see his battles with radio executives, most notably the egotistical young Southerner he dubs Pig Vomit, played with uproarious verve by Paul Giamatti. From the moment Howard first arrives in New York, Pig Vomit tries to whip him into line.
"And the first thing you've got to do is say the call letters properly. Okay? Now, I'm going to teach you how to sing. All right? And you know, I hope you can get them, because, see, you don't have a real good voice like I'm as Captain Frank or nothing, so we're going to have to practice it. Okay, you ready? The way it's said properly is WNBC. This is key. Come on.
WNBC.
No,
Gotta be more like this. Listen up. WNBC. You hear that kind of lift? NBC.
WNBC. WNBC. WNBC.
The first thing to be said about Private Parts is that it's funny, though not always in the subtlest of ways. I don't want to give away any good jokes, but one scene involves a retarded man in a Frisbee, while in another, Howard has a busty blonde straddle a stereo speaker as he moans into the microphone. It's hard to say whether Howard's actually a real actor, but he's very good at playing himself at many different ages, despite sporting some of the most terrifying wigs imaginable. And like all great comedians, he's got crack timing that can salvage the lamest jokes. But while the movie's amusing, it's also tame, as if Howard's wooing the parents of his real fans. In a sense, Private Parts is the opposite of pictures like Blue Velvet, which suggest that beneath the serene surface of middle-class life, America is driven by violence and sexual cravings. This movie suggests that beneath the libidinous wildness of Howard Stern's act, there's a nice Jewish boy who's loyal to his friends, loving to his wife, and driven by the spirit of good fun, even when he's making racist jokes. About half an hour in, my flesh began to crawl from all the clumsy scenes devoted to proving what a wonderful guy Howard Stern really is. Part of his charm has always been his sense of self-deprecation, but here, self-deprecation is just a higher form of self-congratulation. Even worse, it's boring. What makes Howard interesting is not the fact that he's privately Beaver Cleaver, but the Eddie Haskell glee of his public persona, a modern lord of misrule who subverts the rules of decent society every day on the air. To insist that he's really just another lovable guy cheats him of his outlaw edge. It housebreaks his satiric brilliance. Now, I can't blame a guy for wanting to be loved. We all want to be loved. I want to be loved. And if you want to love me, call my producer, Phyllis. And if you've got really nice breasts, maybe you can join us in the studio next week. You up for that, Phyllis?
Sounds great, John.
That's what I love about this chick. She's on for anything. Anyway, what was I saying? Oh, that's right. I was saying that I don't blame Howard for wanting to be loved, but I do blame him for making a movie that tries to bully me into thinking he's lovable. And I blame him even more for doing 10 million interviews just like the showbiz creeps he's always hated, and for telling me over and over that Private Parts has the highest preview scores in Paramount history. Shut the hell up, Howard, you jerk, you phony putz. You want me to love you, Howard? Well, I say love this.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Well, I think Howard Stern would be too self-effacing to tell you this himself, but the soundtrack for his film is already topping the charts. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Roberta Shura. I'm Tariq Rose.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.